Welcome to Success Made to Last. I'm Tim Moore. This is the podcast that helps you live the best version of you. Brought to you by Gracefully Yours. Today's guest, for the second time, is Fred Lynn, the great friend Lynn. Fred played his college ball at USC, where his team won the College World Series 71 through 73. And he had a career average there of 320. Earning 1971 All-College World Series team honors. He was drafted by the Red Sox in 73, spent almost two years in their farm system, and was called up in 1974, where he batted 419 in 63 games, a harbinger of things to come. In 75, Fred had a humongous year, batting 331 with an OBP of 401 and an OPS on-base percentage plus slugging of nearly 1,000. He became the first person to win the Rookie of the Year and MVP honors. The other followed later was Ichiro Suzuki, and added the Gold Glove Award that year just for good measure, which also had never been done by a rookie. During his 7 years in Boston, Fred batted 308 with an OBP of 383 and an OPS of 902. He finished his 17-year career batting 283 with 300 homers and 1,111 RBIs. That's the same intro I used the last time, Fred, but I'm sure it never gets tiring to hear it again. How are you today?
Sometimes you forget some of the things that you accomplished, especially as a young man. So it jogged back again and to hear some of the nice things that you're saying.
Well, yeah, it's got to be. I've got to believe that even though you played in, at the highest level of the sport, it's still a lot of fun to think about it and hear people say nice things. Fred, thanks for coming on again. We had so much fun the first time. I guess we had to do it again. as you remember your Boston days, and certainly I found it, or as I remember you in your Boston days, as watching you on TV and listening to you being interviewed and all that, and reading about you in that great sports page that the Boston Globe had at that time. And I certainly found this to be true in our first podcast. You are a relentlessly positive guy. So how are you coping with this pandemic, Fred?
When we first started hearing about this and we first were start being affected by it in my area, none of us really knew what to do other than the fact that we were washing our hands more than I've ever done in my life. Seems like whatever task I did, I just immediately started washing my hands. Now it's like second nature, and the social distancing kind of thing. That was probably the most difficult part for us here and for me in particular, because, I'm a fairly social guy, but, the golf courses are closed and all those kinds of things that we used to do for social activity, we can't do. So we're doing a lot of FaceTime things. A lot of my friends, we'll have a glass of wine and we'll do FaceTime and we'll talk to each other. I'm doing a lot more social media than I ever have in my life with Facebook and Twitter. And I just joined the website Cameo. So I'm still connected with the fans, and that's been really good for me. And I think for the fan base too, because we're discussing things and I'm trying to be positive and I'm trying to throw some stories out there that they haven't heard before. And so it's just maybe if I can bring a smile to somebody on one particular day, that's kind of what we're doing right now.
Well, that sounds great. Fans, particularly as we get older, fans have a really extraordinarily warm spot in their heart for their heroes when they were kids. And so that's great that you're doing that and that you realize that, just by being you, that you can make people feel better. Fred, where did you get that relentless optimism? Is it something you were born with? Did it come from your parents? I mean, where does that come from? It jumps out at you on the phone here. Where does that come from?
You know what? That's a really good question, and one that's really never been asked of me before. And so I was thinking about it, and I think it's kind of hardwired into me. Although, I've always been an athlete, even as a kid, during recess, I'm always doing things. And I always remember that it seemed to me it was better for me personally and for the people around me if I saw the good part of them or the good part of the situation. And I never could see any reason to dwell on the negative. It was always counterproductive, especially as an athlete. I don't want to think about the things that are going wrong. Maybe I'll learn from those things, but you move on. And so I think some of it's hardwired, and some of it was probably learned as just being an athlete.
Yeah, that's a good answer. Your parents, I'm sure, had something to do with it too, Fred.
Yeah, I believe so. you know, we're always kind of a glass half full in the household. And, you know, my parents, you know, hardworking blue-collar people, I think that probably came from them a little bit. But I still think it's, you either have that kind of attitude or you don't. I think you could probably foster it in the home with a great family, those kinds of things. But you still have to continue it. You know, you can have the basis, you could have the foundation laid out for you, but it's up to you to further that and use it the rest of your life.
Yeah, to continue it on. And the other thing that I wanted to talk to you a little bit about, we talked about your Boston career in the first interview, and that's certainly particularly relevant to me because, you know, I lived in Boston, as you know, during your heyday there. But let's go back to the second half of your career. It's a part of your career we didn't cover, and continue our discussion of really of how people who seek and achieve greatness think, because that's what we really like to talk about on this show. And was one of the reasons why I've enjoyed talking to you in these two conversations. You know, I didn't realize it, Fred, but your 79 year was, I mean, immensely. It was much better than your 75 year. When you look at the numbers, I mean, you led in every major statistical category that exists except for RBIs, which 40 years later, we don't think is as important as it was considered back then. You batted .333. You had an OBP, an on-base percentage of .423, an OPS of 1.059. That's an extraordinary number. And as I said to last time, for young people today, that is, you know, the only guy on the planet right now doing that kind of stuff is Mike Trout. The slugging percentage is .637. And you led the team with the league with home runs at 39, and you finished fourth in the MVP balloting. Your team won 91 games. What was going on there, Fred? Now, for those of you who don't want to look it up, Don Baylor won that year. He batted about .283, and he had a 30 something home runs and 139 RBIs. But do you ever think about that year and the irony of it all?
Well, you know, after the 78 season, obviously ended on a sour note for the Red Sox as we lost our 163rd game to the Yankees in the playoffs. And what
I promise never to mention that, Fred.
That's okay. That's okay. It's fresh in my mind. You know, what happened in having played with Jim Rice since we were kids, basically, through AA, AAA, and we came up from the minors together. And Jimmy was a big, strong guy, and I noticed that
yes.
He never really wore down as far as his second half numbers. I mean, he put up the same kind of numbers usually in the second half as he did the first half, whereas myself, I did not. And I really saw it happen in 78. I had a really great first half, as the team did. And then the second half, I started to wear out. You know, I'm not a big guy by any stretch of the imagination. So I tried to figure out in the offseason, what could I do to maintain more strength the second half? And so after the 7-8 year, I started to lift weights. And that was kind of taboo back then. And, you know, I lived in the West Coast, and nobody was telling me how to do any of these things. I happened to have a friend of mine who had a rehab clinic, and he was my ex-trainer at USC. And so I went over there and started doing Nautilus. It's just kind of, it would be like an executive man workout. They had like 10 machines, and you just go from machine to machine. Didn't do much free weight kind of stuff. And I just kind of did it on my own and just to see what would happen. And then I came back in spring training, and Jimmy goes, "Wow, you look like the Hulk." I said, "What do you mean?" He says, "You're much bigger." And I started hitting BP and stuff, and the ball started flying out of the park. I said, "Well, this is different." because I, you know, 175-pound guy, I used to have to hit him right on the screws to get him out. Well, now I saw that I didn't have to hit it great, which was unique for me, and the balls were flying out, and I got off to a real hot start with home runs in April, and in my second half stats actually were good, and I was like, well, this is the key. This is the key. And as far as the things that I was able to do that year, Jimmy and I, we always pushed each other. And going into early August, we were both in contention for the Triple Crown. I was way ahead of him in average, but we were very similar in home runs and RBIs. And so that was kind of the talk. You know, you two guys vying for the Triple Crown on the same club, never happened. And then, you know, the team was doing okay, but, you know, there were teams that were as good as us or better in the league. And so we kind of got put on the back burner when it came down to MVP kind of stuff at the end of the year. You know, we just kind of – we didn't have enough pitching to get us through. We had tons of hitting. And, you know, I had a great statistical season, but they said – I heard this from a number of people. Writers says, well, you know, Donnie Baylor was going to win the MVP, and his team won and yours didn't. I said, well, okay. You know, there's nothing you could do about it. I said, okay. And then, you know, like a year later, Robin Yount's team comes in last, and he wins the MVP. And we go, wait a minute. What happened to that thing last year? But, you know, that's the thing about awards. You know, I never played for them. They're nice to achieve, but, you know, there's who knows why you get an award or why people vote for you. You never know. So, or why they don't. So those kinds of things are nice when you get them, but I never strived for them, and that's one of the reasons.
Yeah, and I suspect, given the answer that you gave to another question last time we talked, that you were probably far more disappointed in not, you know, getting into the playoffs that year than you were in not winning the MVP. That was a very good baseball team. It still won 91 games, but it wasn't good enough to win, the 95 that at 79. Who was that year? Baltimore that year?
I think it was Baltimore and the Yanks were always tough, but Baltimore, you know, was always good. You know, they
were Yankees
in the mix
collapsed
every year.
They collapsed that year in the second half.
Yeah, you know, it used to be called in the 70s the Beast of the East.
Yes.
Baltimore, New York, and the Red Sox. And we used to feast on other teams, but we had to play each other, you know, 20 times a year. And, you know, it was a difficult time to get into the playoffs when there was no wild card.
Yes, yes. Fred, you know, you had 39 home runs that year. And, you know, what people always think about the Fenway Monster in left field and its short porch. But it's 406 down the right field line. You were hitting into some deep territory there to get 39 home runs. And you were hitting in some parks outside of Boston, like Detroit, which I believe was still at 467 in center field. And there were some other vestigial, some older stadia, like I think Cleveland Municipal Stadium is still around at some ungodly amount. I mean, if you played in today's bandboxes, at least that year, you could have had 60 home runs yourself.
I would have had a lot more. There's no question about that. Probably the average back then, because a lot of the stadiums that we played in the 70s were football stadiums, and they just decided to throw a baseball field on them. There weren't many, if any, fields other than Fenway that was just for baseball. You know, most of them were combinations. So the dimensions were huge in a lot of them. Like you mentioned Detroit, Chicago. The White Sox stadium was 363 down the line, down the line. And it was 440 the center, 400 in the gaps. I mean, these are big ball yards.
Yes.
And so you had to pull the ball to hit home runs. I mean, that was the mantra when I came into the league, and I was a dead pull hitter. I mean, I saw the wall in left field, and I changed my swing a little bit to adapt to that dimension and, you know, try to get balls off the wall. But I pulled everything to hit home runs, except in Fenway was no good because 301 down the line in right field, but you pace off 15 feet mm-hmm. from the line and then mm-hmm. go straight back mm-hmm. to the wall. It's 380.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and I thought it was 406, 380, okay.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. It's Death Valley yeah. there. It was easier to hit it into the Red Sox bullpen than to hit it almost down the line. So fortunately, I was bigger and stronger, and I could reach a lot of the ballparks in today's world. Boy, you wouldn't even have to hit them as good. And the guys are so big and strong today, I don't see how or why somebody doesn't threaten 60 home runs every year. You just have to make solid contact and they're gone. So it was a big deal to hit a home run for me back in the 70s. It really was. And that year was a lot of fun just because I was hitting the ball out of the ballpark with more frequency. But I always had the capability of doing that. Even in college, my sophomore year, I led the nation in home runs. Who knew? I hit 14 and that led the nation, but that was with a wood bat. We played with wood. So even as a smaller guy, I had the potential to hit home runs, but I was real streaky with them because that swing would come and go. But I always hit for average, but every once in a while I'd get into a streak and hit a bunch of homers.
What are the two or three things that you think of when you compare your era with today's that are so different? I mean, you mentioned size, for instance. You know, Mickey Mantle was considered to be a big, strong guy with those big miner's forearms of his, and he was 5'11", 195. Today, that would be considered puny, if not puny, not big anyway. I mean, that's got to be one of the things, I guess. But what are the other things that jump out at you that make the game so much different today than it was then, even though it's the same game?
Well, you mentioned specifically the ballparks. I mean, that's probably number one because today's ballparks are for baseball. And I've been fortunate enough to be able to see a lot of these newer parks and been on the field. And what I notice is that the outfields are perfect. I mean, they're level. You could play pool on them. They drain well. You don't have to worry about any of those things. You spoke of Mickey Mantle. Well, he hurt his knee running for ball in Yankee Stadium because they had sprinklers, the rainbirds, you know, the pop-ups. And those things, they sink down into the ground. And so there's like a 4-inch gap between the level of grass and the top of the rainbird. And he hit one of those, and that's how he hurt his knee. And so I used to see those things in the outfield, and I'd have the grounds crew come out and cover them with sand just to make it level. You know, today's players don't have to worry about those kinds of things. But so the undulations of the outfield have changed a lot. But here's something that most people don't talk about. It's the baseball. In the 70s, baseball was put into play, and it came out of play when it was either damaged or you hit it in the sands. So you could play with one ball for two or three innings. I'm going to let that sink in because in today's game, if a pitcher throws a breaking ball and hits the dirt, they just roll it out. They throw that ball out. Well, back in our day, pitchers threw a lot of sinker slider. They were sinker slider types, right? So they wanted to keep the ball down and sink it. Today's guys are all about throwing it as hard as they can. They don't want any scuffs on it. They want it to be aerodynamically clean so that it gets through much quicker. They want to throw hard. They throw as hard as they can all the time. Our guys were more economical the way they pitched. They wanted to get you out with one pitch. Here's a little sinker. Oh, hit a ground ball in a second. Thank you very much. One pitch, one out. So now that ball that we played with, I had balls hit to me for like the third out of the inning in center field, and I'd feel it, and it was all scuffed up, and you could almost move the hide with your finger. That's how soft they were. Those balls today, they'd laugh at you. We wouldn't even use this for BP. And to coincide that with a sinking type fastball, so guys would get balls that are scuffed up, right? Well, you get a scuff on a baseball, and you know what you're doing as a pitcher, you can make that ball move one way or the other, just by how you hold the scuff. And then so now you have pitchers that are a little bit more creative. I used to call them carpenters. You know, they used to take thumbtacks and nail files out on the mound, and I had them in their pockets, and they did all kinds of things to the baseball to doctor them up to make them move. Spitters, right? So guys threw a lot more spitballs then, because you threw off a sinker, you throw a great spitter, you just say, well, that was a great sinker. No one can throw a spitter today because hardly anybody sinks the ball. You get a ball staying on the same plane at 95, and all of a sudden one drops out of the sky. We go, hey, what was that? Mm-hmm. So that's a big difference, the philosophy of the pitchers. They throw as hard as they can for as long as they can, which is not very long, and they never finish anything. Our guys, our starters, finish games. They finished. Relievers, you could sit in the pen sometimes for a week and not get a call because our starters were doing the job. That's their job, was to start and finish. So that's a big difference in the game. And there are a lot more nutrition and how guys prepare off, in the off season. They're constantly working out. They're getting all the benefits of all the knowledge that goes into the human body. They have all those things. And we had guys with second jobs.
Right.
Making as much money. So there's just a ton of differences. We could have a show just on that. But those are just some of the highlights, especially the way the pitchers think and the ball itself. I mean, the ball's out of play. I don't know how many baseballs they use in a game. It used to be that the umpires would rub up, say, like 5 dozen baseballs. And they'd sit in their little room, it's a cubicle before the game, with their special mud from South Carolina or where it was, and they rub up all the balls. Well, that's because you could play with 4 or 5 dozen because you wouldn't use them all. Well, I don't know how many they do now, and I guarantee you the umpires aren't rubbing them up. They must have a machine that does it because they must use 12 dozen. and then after the inning, the guys throw them into the stands. So, oh, by the way, that used to be a fine.
Yes, in I remember day, that. You're right. I'd forgotten.
Yeah, if you threw a ball into the stands, it was a $100 fine from the league. And I found out why, because if I threw a ball into the stands and there's a fight for it, basically, somebody could get hurt and it could sue the ball club. So $100 fine. That's changed. So there's just a few of the highlights.
Yeah, that ball issue is, that you mentioned, I do remember that the ball would have stayed in play longer. But talk about a subtle issue, but an important one.
Oh my gosh.
Oh my goodness gracious. Absolutely. It's funny you mentioned the number of balls too. I was watching before the virus hit, a University of Texas baseball game, on Longhorn Network down here. And it was a long game. It was like 11 or 12 innings. Greg Swindell, who's one of the announcers, you may know Greg for all I know. But anyway, Swindell was one of the announcers, and he said, we just got word that that's the 72nd ball that's been hit out of play today. I thought to myself, 72nd? How many did the pros go through?
Oh, yeah, I can't even imagine. To go back to the ball issue a little bit, at Fenway Park, I'm sure you were there many times, there was a net above the Green Monster.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a ladder there. Well, that ladder was there so the guys could climb up and get the balls in the net. And we would use those in BP. And we use them, repetitively. And so it was so discouraging in batting practice because you're using old balls. And, the Red Sox weren't exactly giving us new balls. They were a little frugal when it came to that kind of thing. So, you'd be smashing them and they'd go nowhere. You'd go, ugh. Go into the game like, God, I just lost my power.
No kidding. Well, let me pause just for a second on that note, Fred, and so that we can bring on our sponsor to do a commercial, and that sponsor is Gracefully Yours.
And thanks to our sponsor, Gracefully Yours greeting cards and their hilarious Church Kitchen Lady cards. Church Kitchen Ladies are a bunch of maybe 20 million volunteers across the United States that work in 300,000 churches, and they say stuff like, mind your own biscuits and life will be gravy. They also say, crunch tacos, not abs. And psst, your crazy is showing, you might want to tuck that back in. And one of our favorites is, life is short, lick the bowl. If you want to find out more about the wonderful Church Kitchen Ladies and join their roundtable, go to gracefully-yours.com today and find out about Church Kitchen Ladies and purchase all the rest of the fine Gracefully Yours greeting cards.
Okay, Fred, let's go back to the conversation. Fred, in 1981, you got traded to California. In what media sources, you know, and at the time referred to as a kind of snafu that the Red Sox made, and not only in trading you, but some contractual issues related to that. But you got to go back home. But I've heard you in another interview, or maybe I read it one or the other, that as I understand it, while Southern California was and is home, Boston by then felt like home. Talk about your mindset at that time, Fred. What goes through your mind through all of that?
It was a big change for me. You know, when you go, as my career went, you know, you spent time in high school, and you have a finite time in those places, high school, college. But when I signed with the Red Sox, I thought I'd be a Red Sox, you know, till the end of my career. That's how I thought. I was a pretty loyal guy. That's the way I said, okay, I'm a Red Sox, great. And then after in the 80 season, Carlton Fisk, Rick Burleson, and myself, our contracts were coming up. We had signed 5-year deals. And so all our contracts would come up at the same time. And the Boston media was saying, you know, that Rooster and I, you know, we wanted to go out west, and Carlton, he wants too much money, you know, local guy, and wants too much money. And it was only, they were trying to spin it so that it looked like we wanted more money than we were worth or whatever. And so that's what the fans, I think, thought. But for me personally, when it finally went down, and there was a contractual snafu, they sent Carlton Fisk and my contract out late,
right,
so
that
we were
going to
be declared. Yeah, we were going to be declared free agents in New York. See an arbitrator, be declared a free agent. Well, Fiske and I were in New York, and part the midnight before the arbitration hearing, the Red Sox and the Angels agreed to a quote unquote trade. So basically, we circumvented going through the arbitration process and free agency almost, and because Gene Autry was one of the guys that everybody was targeting because he wanted to win, so he would pay top dollar for his players. So anyway, there was a trade, and the Red Sox actually got bodies for me, although it was not really not a trade, but that's what it mm-hmm. turned that timed mm-hmm. out as a trade. So. And then Fisk the next day was declared a free agent, and he signed with the White Sox. But the way I thought about it was, you know, as an athlete, you can't get all caught up in the mental aspect of it, because you have to perform. Okay, I've been traded. Now I'm an Angel. I can't dwell on what had happened or why it happened. That would be, again, counterproductive for me. So I said, okay, I'm an Angel, and I'm going to do the best I can for the Halos and try to win out here. It wasn't until much later on, and I look back on it, and I said, what the heck? How can you get rid of Carlton Fisk, Rick Burleson, and Fred Lynn, who are the guts of the defense, your shortstop,
right at the middle.
Your center fielder,
yep.
and your catcher, your number 2-3-5 hitter in the lineup? It just didn't make any sense. I don't care what kind of money was. I found out later it was more a personal matter with Mrs. Yockey than it was anything else. So to go home to play, I said, well, this is going to be good. It would have if I had gone from SC to, say, the Dodgers or the Angels and never had gone to Boston or experienced East Coast baseball. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I got spoiled a little bit by playing in Boston, and because of the way the fans are, they're so knowledgeable, and they're fervent, and they show up. They demand excellence, and so I got, you know, that's what I demanded of myself. And then when you come out west, it's so laid back. The beach is 20 minutes away, and you know, people stroll into the ballpark in the third inning and they're leaving in the eighth, and I'm screaming, where are you going? So
yes,
it was nice to play in the good weather, and it's sort of nice to be home, but playing at home comes with a different set of problems. Not problems much, but things that you don't deal with out east. For me, I had a lot of friends, and they want to come to the games all the time, and I felt like Ticketron, you know, making sure my family and my friends and friends of family and people that I didn't even know were saying, hey, we want to go to the game, and so all kinds of different things that you don't think about when you're away from your basically your home base. But yeah, it was when you get traded the first time, it changes you. It definitely changes you. So now you just say, okay, you know, I hated to think of myself as getting a paycheck kind of guy, but it is a business, and so sometimes you have to look at it like that. But that's not how I wanted to look at it.
Yeah, that's understandable, isn't it? It's even as fans, you know, we appreciate the fact that, you know, when you're at the pinnacle of your profession, you ought to make the pinnacle money. End of story. But we do miss you when you go.
me too.
You know, and I'm sure many of the players miss the places they've been to. It was a great place to be. You're right about Boston. And, of course, you were also had the, you know, you had also the 19 or 20 games a year with New York, you know, arguably the best rivalry in all of sports in the world, perhaps. That in and of itself is a season within a season. But California wasn't so good in 80, you know, or for that matter, 81, 65 and 95 and 80. So you weren't exactly going to a powerhouse, although in 82, the team had a great year and you all went to the playoffs. But sports can be, you know, exhilarating and they can be cruel, you know, the old ABC, the agony of defeat and whatever the other was. And, you know, you were shaping up to have basically a Hall of Fame career, Fred, and then the injury bug keeps biting at you. In 1981, you only played in 76 games and you had three more great years, but, in fact, you won the MVP in 1982 for a losing team, the only person to ever do that, at least the first player, but I think also the only. But then you start to lose a significant time year after year with your plate appearances dropping. How does a guy who's been the best player on the field everywhere he's gone in his life deal with that?
Yeah, that's a good question, and I didn't deal with it very well, to be honest with you.
Well, that's okay.
I expect a lot of myself, and I always have, and I'm no good to anyone if I'm hurt, if I'm off the field. As you mentioned, you know, I'm one of the better players on the team, and I feel like I'm letting my team down. And my city, it's really tough when you can't be out there. I was like a caged tiger. And consequently, when things started popping up as far as injuries are concerned, we didn't have the kind of medical staff that they do now. And a lot of times, as a player, and I'm a center fielder, so I have to be able to run. I have to cover a lot of ground. I'm a gold glove guy. I have standards that I have to live up to, not only for myself, but for the team and everybody else that watches me. I didn't want to go out there and hurt my team by being a defensive liability. And plus, a lot of the teams I played on, they wouldn't let me DH because that was a significant spot for somebody else who couldn't field. So if I didn't play defense, I wasn't going to be in the lineup. And it was, oh boy, yeah. I'd say I pulled a groin or did something where I couldn't run. Invariably, I would try to come back too soon. Mm-hmm. And because I couldn't sit around and just watch, it wouldn't go on the DL because that's 2 weeks. And I'd just say, okay, you know, I'm ready. And you know, we didn't have a lot of therapy. There's not a lot of things that you could do back then. You just, and I had some injuries where you couldn't tell I was injured, you know, the bones not sticking out of my leg or something like that. Mm-hmm. And so for the fans, well, he looks all right, get him in there. And so I would. And then when you come back too soon, you re-injure yourself and you put yourself off even more. And sometimes I was having some back issues back then. And one thing kind of leads to another. If you start to try to cover up for an injury on your body, say it's your back, and then you start doing something that messes something else up. You know, you walk funny and you hurt your knee, or you do this, and one thing leads to another. And there's like a little bit of a domino effect. But it was really difficult for me being injured. I hated it. I absolutely hated every second of it. And I tried to do everything I could to get back in there, and I had ankle problems since I was a kid. I sprained an ankle, like I think I was 12. It's my left ankle, my back foot as a hitter. And I did it once in college, and then I tore ligaments in that same ankle in 77 with the Sox. So once you sprain an ankle like that, or you have an injury to your ankle, you're susceptible to re-injuring it again all the time. And even I tape up, like played football, I taped up all the time, every game. And my ankles, you know, that's when you're limping a little bit here, and then your back goes out. And then, so the second half of my career seemed like just a calamity of maladies. And I just couldn't keep in the lineup, couldn't get enough at bats. There was nothing wrong with my ability. You know, all I needed was give me 500 bats, and I'm going to be an all-star. I'm going to do the things that you think I could do. That's just the way it is. And I just couldn't get enough at bats to do those kinds of things that I'm supposed to do. So it was very discouraging. It was very tough for me. And eventually is the reason why I quit playing.
Yeah. It's as I think about, you know, greatness and, you know, all you guys and the pros are great athletes, but it just has to be when that injury bug starts to hit you, it just has to be almost overwhelming because you're used to literally having your mind push you forward to success and all of those things that were strengths mentally to you in the past all of a sudden seem to be liabilities, don't they?
Well, you know what? I kind of, when I got in my mid-30s, I'm thinking of all the things I did as a kid, all right? So it kind of like it was a cumulative effect of all the things that I did harm to my body, and it just kind of caught up with me. I mean, I was a crazy guy. I mean, I used to jump off roofs for kicks when I was like 10. I did all these kind of crazy things, and I played four sports, and I played football from Pop Warner through high school and even in college. So I had a lot of contact. When I played baseball, there was no padding on anything. When we did have fences in college, there were cinder block walls. I hit those things. There were no rules about taking guys out at second, so I throw roll body blocks. I did all this stuff. And after a while, when you have a body like mine, you know, I'm like a greyhound. I'm built for speed and endurance. I could run you to death. I mean, when I played basketball, I never came out of a game. My biggest attribute is my ability to run forever and run guys down in the fourth quarters, like football or basketball. I couldn't use that in baseball. It's an attribute that I could never use. And it was my best attribute as far as I'm concerned, my ability to just keep on going. Well, all those kinds of things that I did leading up to my mid-30s, keep on going and smashing stuff, I think it caught up to me.
Well, again, you know, it's funny. That's another difference between today's game and the game of your era, Fred, is the medical aspect of it. You've hit on it a couple of different ways, but, you know, today's teams wouldn't let you back on the field until they thought you were healed up, for instance. So it's a lot of differences. So at some point, you know, one has to retire. And when the greats retire from the game, you know, as you did, you hold a press conference and fans cry, and sometimes the greats cry, and sometimes even the reporters cry. And it's like a death. And it's like a death at a young age. I mean, I'm sure you've even experienced it yourself, watching others retire. You know, when you know that you'll never see, you know, Yaz on the field again, when you know that you'll never see, you know, Carlton Fisk on the field again, and when, in your case, when you knew that you wouldn't be on the field again, How did you approach all of that, and how did you approach even the thought of retirement? Because you guys are retiring, quote unquote, at a very young age, aren't you?
Yeah, that's very true. So what I learned by watching other guys, and when I was, you know, I was 38 my last year, I was playing with San Diego, and you start to think about the end because it's right there knocking on your doorstep. And what I saw was that and learned from other guys is don't make any big decisions that first year, because you're not going to be mentally the same as you were or should be. At 3 o'clock, my body, you know, when I didn't retire, by the way, I just stopped playing. And I was no official, I'm retiring, that kind of thing. You know, I worked out in the off season and when I was 38, and I just didn't get any kind of offers that I thought mm-hmm. were realistic. And plus I was banged up. I was banged up. So I just decided, okay, I just walked away into the sunset kind of thing. No fanfare. So what I learned was that, okay, don't make any crazy decisions here, because at 3 o'clock, my body wants to go do this thing that you've been doing for 20 years and you're not doing it. And so you're mentally like, wow, it's not so much physical, but mentally you're like fried a little bit. And so don't buy a new house. Don't do anything crazy. Just kind of chill. And I didn't really plan for retirement, sort of, but because of the things that I had done in the game, I thought something might pop up, right? And literally it did. As soon as I said I'm not playing anymore, ESPN contacted me and asked me if I'd like to interview for a job. I never interviewed for a job in my life. You know, interview for a job means a tryout on the field. That was a unique experience for me, you know, putting on a coat and tie and talking to their executives, and they gave me a shot. And so I did ESPN for 8 years. I was a baseball analyst for them. I did the College World Series, which was a great thing for me to do. I got all kinds of friends now in Omaha because I did it for 8 years. And I did baseball analyst for CBS. I did some Fox work as well. So it was a real a cool experience for me, and it was a great segue into the real world. As athletes, we live in this bubble. I don't really care what's happening in the rest of the world. You have such a short time to be an athlete that that's all you think about, really. At least we did. And so now you're in the real world. You're with real people. And now it's like, ooh, okay, this is an adjustment, but mine was a great segue, because coming out of baseball, going into broadcast, I still got to go to the stadiums, you know, different time in a different spot, but I was still going. I was still seeing the guys, and I knew them all. And that's why ESPN did those kinds of things, because, you know, I had relevance and I knew everybody. So it was really worked out well. And the one positive thing about retiring or quitting your job at 38, I went from being the old guy. Oh, man, he's the oldest guy. He's older than the dirt. Now I'm a young man. It's been in one day. I went from the old goat to a young man. I was like, woohoo!
Well, that's putting a positive spin on it, certainly, Fred. Fred, that's going to do it for today. Although, as you know, I had more questions, but we may have to talk again at some point.
I get a little gabby sometimes.
Oh, not at all. No, it's joyous to listen to. Frankly, I'm sure. You know, we're broadcasting the first episode on the 30th of April, and so for those of you out there in podcast land, it's before the 30th of April today. I did send you the first interview with you to some of my friends in Boston, and I'll tell you that they were almost weepy when they called me. I mean, it was they were so happy to hear from you, and I gotta believe that, you know, anybody listening to these, well, no matter what team they rooted for, whether they were in Boston or not, it's gotta be just finding your voice and your energy and your positivity to be fabulous. I want to thank you again. And and yes, I'll communicate with Natalie, and maybe we can do it again. And I have a couple of other ideas, but that's for another day as well, Fred. But thank you very much.
Oh, yes, it's my pleasure. It's great for me to be able to do this, especially under the circumstances. And like I said before, like if we could put smiles between you and I on people's faces just for a short time, it's well worth the effort.
Yes, it is. It's funny, but it sounds like a cliche. But I leave this podcast feeling uplifted, and I hope other people feel that way too. So I hope you all out there have enjoyed this podcast, and remember to go to successmadetolast.com to register for our newsletter filled with fun information about our future guests, and I think some great stuff in general. And go to your podcast distributor, iTunes, Spreaker, whomever, and rate our show, please. Till next time, go out there and live with the best version of you. And once again, Fred, thank you very, very much.
So thanks to our sponsor, Edward Jones. They are our trusted financial advisor. And Edward Jones has been instrumental in helping us pivot our lives built around health, happiness, travel, and adding value to other people's lives. You can contact our advisor, Serban Marasini, by emailing him at serban.marasini@edwardjones.com. And thanks again to their sponsorship of this program.